It's interesting. The founders, I think, thought about a lot. They were the products of a chaotic time, right? They had, they've been lived through military coups, revolutions, disorder. And so they thought about a lot of things happening that we haven't had to think about for a long time. And this is a good example. So they had thought about what happens if a president is removed from office, president who dies in office, and then the president who's unable to perform the job. But what they didn't really think about was temporary disability.
Welcome to my dad podcast.
This is the 1787 Project, the podcast version of the lectures for my socially distanced class on the U.S. Constitution at the University of Missouri. I'm your professor and host, Justin Dyer. Last weekend, the Wall Street Journal ran an op-ed piece by Berkeley Law professor John Yoo titled A Winding Constitutional Path from Trump to Pence to Pompeo. It's about presidential succession, and Yoo's argument is that this obscure part of Article 2 in the Constitution means that the Secretary of State and not the Speaker of the House should be third in line for the presidency, despite what the Presidential Succession Act of 1947 says about it. John was kind enough to have a Zoom call with me this week to talk about the article and a couple of other topics that are relevant to our class. And a bit about John Yoo. He's the Emanuel Heller Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's the author of a number of books on the Constitution and foreign affairs. Before his academic career, he was a clerk for Justice Clarence Thomas, and he served from 2001 to 2003 in the Office of Legal Counsel in the U.S. Department of Justice. He came out to Mizzou back in 2016 for a debate with Professor Alberto Cole on the question of whether the president needs approval or authorization from Congress before taking the country to war. So we talk about that debate a bit, but our conversation starts with the subject of his Wall Street Journal op-ed piece, and that's the Constitution and the Presidential Succession Act. When the article was published over the weekend, President Trump had just tested positive for coronavirus, and he had been sent to Walter Reed Hospital for treatment and monitoring. There was a lot of confusion about the health status of the president. So Yoo's article explored the timely question of presidential succession. What happens if the president is too sick to do his job? What happens if he dies? What if the vice president gets sick too? The Constitution addresses all of those scenarios, or at least makes it so that Congress, by law, can address those scenarios. So we'll dive right in here, in the middle of our conversation about his article and about the constitutional puzzle of presidential succession.
The 25th Amendment, which is added, I think it's in 1967 after the Kennedy assassination, because Ray Kennedy didn't die right away in the assassination. He lived on for a few more hours. Raises question that people thought to address in the amendment. What happens if a president is temporarily disabled? He's not killed. He's not permanently unable. He's not been impeached and removed. Those were the context of the Constitution already has provision for. So it's really interesting. There's two different ways. There's the voluntary way and the involuntary way. So the voluntary way is the president just says to the Congress, I am going to be unable to discharge the power and duties of my office. And that while I'm in this period, the vice president will be, it's interesting, acting president. When a vice president replaces a dead president, he becomes president. There's no acting president. But here in the 25th Amendment, it's interesting, they use this phrase, acting president. And then when that period is over, right, then he's back to, the president returns to office and the vice president goes back to being vice president. That's something you could do, say, with COVID. If you know you're going to be sick, you're worried about being delirious or unconscious, and you have time beforehand to do something. That's this voluntary procedure. The one that is the subject of innumerable episodes of the TV show 24 or many movies like Air Force One and so on is the second method, involuntary. What happens if the president doesn't have time to prepare? What happens if he falls suddenly unconscious? It's interesting in Air Force One, the movie, what if the president is under duress and can't make decisions? So this is a very interesting process. So this requires the vice president. He's the sine qua non first the vice president has to decide to go forward. And then he or she has to get a majority of, we generally think of the cabinet, it's called the principal officers of the executive departments, which today is about 15 people set out in federal law. They have to send a written declaration to Congress that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office. If that happens, the vice president immediately becomes acting president. Now, the interesting thing is this, what about a coup? Suppose the vice president just gets together with the majority of the cabinet just to seize power, or they think the president's unfit, or they don't like the president. They want to get someone else in the job. So this amendment is written to really give the leverage to the president, because if the president comes back, he can immediately say, even the day after, the same day as the vice president triggers this majority of the cabinet approach, the president can send in a letter to Congress saying, I am actually able to do the duties of the job. Or maybe there's been a period where he's been unconscious. He wakes up, he says, I'm ready. I can do the powers of the job. The only way to stop the president from coming back, the vice president and the cabinet have to go through the same routine, reaffirm that the president's disabled. And then 2/3 of the House and the Senate have to agree with him, with the vice president. So if the president can just persuade 1/3 plus 1/3 of the Senate to agree that he's fit to come back to office, then the president automatically wins.
So this is clearly about disability. It's not a replacement for impeachment. It's not like everybody just gets together and decide they don't want him to be president anymore.
Well, this is the interesting thing, is the people who wrote this amendment and ratified it clearly were worried that it would be a kind of cheap, poor man's version of impeachment. Mm-hmm. You could see, right? And there were people at the beginning of the Trump term in office who were saying, let's say he's crazy, right? He's unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, could mean we just think he's unfit.
Oh yeah, there was a lot of 25th Amendment talk exactly. In the last few years.
Yeah, exactly. But what those people who throw that around, they haven't read to the end of the amendment. And if you read to the end of the amendment, it says the president just sends in a letter and he's fit unless 2/3 mm-hmm. of that. And notice the other thing that people don't realize about the amendment is, suppose the House and Senate do that. This actually doesn't prohibit the president from continuing to send in a new letter every day. Maybe Trump would tweet every day, I'm fit.
Man, I'm ready to go. Put me back in there.
I'm fit for office. And the House and Senate would have to get together and by 2/3 vote each time the president sent in that message.
Because the person here is going to be acting president. They're not the new president. Exactly. And so it just continues throughout the term.
Exactly. So the president could harass whoever the acting president is for the rest of, for days mm-hmm. and days upon end, and cause the House and Senate to have to meet every day and say, no, we reject.
And it would actually be easier to impeach at this point, vote-wise, with the House and the Senate.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you were talking about some of the shows. Have you seen Designated Survivor?
Ah, yes. That's the one where Kiefer Sutherland somehow promoted from the 24 show, yeah. Then yes. Suddenly the last time is, I remember alive.
He's a professor who is the HUD secretary, and he gets designated survivor, and they blow up the Capitol building. He becomes president, but it gets into the succession question. And this is the other part of your article where you talk about the Presidential Succession Act. And this is an act passed by Congress in the 1940s. And it's under the authority of Article 2 in the Constitution, yes. Not under the authority of the 25th Amendment. Obviously the 25th Amendment comes later, but it lists who can succeed the president in these different scenarios. And then this interesting question, which I hadn't really thought of, is the question of whether somebody in Congress, whether a legislator could be in the line of succession.
Yeah, this is great. So I haven't actually watched Designated Survivor because I had enough from 24 for Sutherland, but I watched all the 24s. And this came up in 24 all the time, right? Think how many presidents were killed or disabled in that TV show.
Right.
So, in Article 2, it's interesting. It says, in case of the removal of the president from office or his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the office, then it goes to the vice president. And if the vice president also is, dies, resigns, or is unable to discharge, then the Constitution, this is Article 2, Section 1, Clause 9, it says, if both the president and vice president right, can't, then the Congress may provide, may by law provide, what officer shall then act as president. And so under that statute, actually for, I believe until 1947, that statute, Congress had passed a succession statute, which kept every, kept all the people in the chain of succession in the executive branch, cabinet members mostly. In 1947, they changed it to include the speaker, Congress changed it to include the Speaker of the House and the President Pro Tem of the Senate. So that's Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Grassley, to be third and fourth after the president and vice president. Now, my argument is there's a constitutional problem there, because if you remember the text, it said Congress declares what a quote unquote officer shall then act as president. And so I argue the word officer is crucially important, because the Constitution doesn't refer to members of Congress as officers. When it refers to officers, it's usually in the constitutional text talking about what's called an officer of the United States, which is an executive branch official. And so my argument is Congress can't include a member of the legislature in the line of succession, because they, Pelosi and Grassley, are not officers. They are members of Congress. And then I look to some structural arguments. For example, there's the incompatibility clause, which shows a clear desire by the framers to prevent someone from holding legislative and executive branch office at the same time. There's the idea that the presidency was supposed to be independent and separate from Congress and not under their control. You can imagine what would happen if the Speaker of the House became president. You almost have a parliamentary system again. But
so it wouldn't be a matter of holding an office in a legislature and an executive at the same time. It'd be a matter of resigning your office in the legislature and becoming president. Yes. But then that gets into the question of the incompatibility clause and whether you could do that at all.
Yes, exactly. And then also just the use of the word officer suggests that you already have to be a member of the cabinet, for example. So,
is there another place in the Constitution? You said that it usually uses the word officer to mean an executive branch member. Is there a place in the Constitution where it talks about an officer in a different context?
It's a great question. It gets a little crazy here. So I think the other place officer is used is to refer to state officers. You could see a world where, and this actually might make more sense in this world of today, maybe you want governors to include them at the end of the line of succession, you know, especially in a, you want to have decentralization in case of an attack.
Well, even that, when I was reading the incompatibility clause, it says no person holding any office under the United States shall be a member of either house during continuance in office, which makes it sound like, at least for that clause, that holding an office is something you do outside of the legislature, that anybody who holds an office in the United States, and that doesn't include people who are legislators.
Yes. So when you look about, when you look at office, it's usually in that context. It's referring to someone already within Article II. The other clause I'm thinking of is Article VI, the Supremacy Clause, which also has the Oath Clause in it. And so it's interesting. It says, it talks about several state legislatures, and it says executive and judicial officers. Mm-hmm. And then it talks about there can't be a religious test to an office under the United States. So I my argument is just, even in those contexts, they're talking about executive officers. They never use the word they never use officer to refer to a member of Congress. Mm-hmm.
So how does this, how would this play out then? Let's say the president is ill or incapacitated for whatever reason. The vice president goes down as well. We go to number three, according to the law, the Succession Act. It's going to be the Speaker of the House. It would be Pelosi. It would then go to the pro tem of the Senate. But you're saying they are ineligible constitutionally. So does somebody file a lawsuit here? Who has the authority to say that are not going to assume that office?
This is where it kind of gets into the TV movie world. You know, before we even got to court, you would have to transfer the authority of government, right? So who would the military obey? Who would, right, the cabinet officers obey? So this is like the way the Constitution was interpreted in the first, 50, 70 years of our history is the other branches interpret first because they hit the question immediately. And so I would think actually the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense would have to make an initial decision. Are we going to obey?
And the Secretary of State here is going to have a conflict of interest.
Self-interested. Yeah, they're self-interested. Yes. And so they would have to sit in there and say, do we think the Secession Act is constitutional? Because we would, are we going to obey Pelosi, or are we going to say it's unconstitutional and move to Pompeo, Secretary of State Pompeo? Mm-hmm. Only after that, then you could get a court challenge, I suppose, because you could, what would happen is someone, say someone's prosecuted by this new government. Mm-hmm. They could say, I think President Pompeo is unconstitutional because they skipped Pelosi and Grassley.
And Pompeo might be the Pompeo might be the one making the call for the federal government in the first place. Secretary of State saying, actually, I think I'm the president right now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the way it would work in practical, I think, is what would happen is Pelosi would come over to the White House and say, I'm in charge. I want the oath. And then the attorney general would step forward because the attorney general would say, I'm going to interpret the law for the executive branch. And I don't read you as being constitutionally inserted into the line of succession. And so I will order the military to have you removed and the oath of office be given to, you know, the military or the law, FBI, remove her or don't give her the oath and then have it, have the oath administered to Pompeo. Yeah. So I think it would really be up to the attorney general.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we don't get there. It doesn't look like we will in this season. Switching gears a little bit, but thinking about then the presidential authority that a President Pompeo would have if he came into office or whoever else it would be. And one of the big questions that we have about presidential authority is the president's authority in war. And you came out to the University of Missouri several years ago and we did a debate about war powers. And there's this really straightforward way of reading the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 has the enumerated powers of Congress. One of those enumerated powers is to declare war. Congress then has the exclusive power to declare war. And then the president has these other powers, including being commander-in-chief. How should we understand what the Constitution's doing here with war powers?
So under the British Crown, you know, which was a kind of starting point for the Constitution, all the war-making power was in the Crown. But Congress, Parliament had to vote funds and raise the military. And so the major change to that was the transfer of one piece of the war power, which was declaring war, was shifted to Congress in Article 1, Section 8. But the commander-in-chief power was left in the hands of the president. And so I basically take the Hamiltonian position in the sense that everything else is left in the president, and anything you transfer out of the executive power is to be narrowly read. This is the argument Hamilton made for why President Washington could issue a neutrality proclamation. There's no power in this Constitution set out to decide who sets foreign policy at all. So, but it's executive in nature, and so the executive power is given to the president. If it's not taken away and moved to Congress, we assume the president still has it. So that's basically my interpretive approach to war powers too. And so what I did is look at the Declare War Clause. What does Declare War mean to the founders of the 18th century? They don't think it means start war. In fact, there's the other thing I point to is there's Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, right? Just a few clauses away. And I think this clause is really important because it forbids the states from making war. And the phrase they use is no state shall without the consent of the Congress, right? So that's an interesting thing there, right? No state shall, without the consent of Congress, engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. That is exactly what the people who think Congress has to approve war think the Declare War Clause does, except it takes them like three or four clauses to explain it. It even has an exception for self-defense, right? And an immediate attacks and danger, anticipatory self-defense. So the question I've always had is, why didn't they just copy that language and just insert the president shall not, without the consent of Congress, engage in war? You have to assume the words mean different things. So what I argued is declare war doesn't mean authority to engage in war. It means declaring what the legal status of the hostilities are, whether we're at a high level of war or just skirmishes or something in between. But that Congress's real check on war is whether to create the military. And that was, until 1945, a perfect check on the president because we never had a standing army or navy of any size. And so I think Congress has chosen to build an enormous military, an offensive military for the president to use. They don't declare war. They don't not declare war. They don't declare peace either. They just, you know, sort of wash their hands of it and let the president take all the responsibility and run all the risks in defending the nation's security.
In the British model, with these powers united in the crown, what did it mean to declare war? So if a British monarch is going to go to war, and there's a difference between engaging in war and declaring war, when do they declare war? And are these things separated out where sometimes you're engaging in war but not declaring it? And or do they go together?
No, that's a great point. So I actually went back and looked at all of the British wars in the preceding 100 years to the Constitution. And I saw that they only declared war once before hostilities started. Every other war, and Britain was at war all the time in that 100-year period, the declaration of war would sometimes come months or years after hostilities started. And actually, we have a great example from this time period for the Americans who wrote the Constitution. The Declaration of Independence, if you look at it, is identical to a declaration of war. A declaration of war says why we're angry at you, why we're fighting, and it's like a complaint and a lawsuit, and then what remedy we want to what's going to restore the state of peace. A declaration, and actually some historians have said, yeah, the Declaration of Independence is actually an 18th century declaration of war. Mm. When did the fighting start? Lexington and Concord, 1775. The Declaration of Independence is a year later. And so I actually looked, and it would be very common in the British period for the declaration to be issued long after the fighting started. And it was a kind of way to formalize the legal status of the fighting. But it didn't have to do with the domestic constitutional mechanism for starting hostilities. They were separate things. Yeah.
I'll have to invite Professor Cole to come on and talk a little bit about his perspective on this. And so I want to push a little bit on it, but I was thinking more about pushing on his perspective than yours. But I'd be curious if you have thoughts on this. When people try to defend, as he did in his debate with you, this idea that Congress has a specific power to authorize war, it's usually qualified in this sense that, you know, he argues that Congress should authorize major wars. And then he even says at one point that a congressional authorization of the use of force like we have after 9/11 or that we get with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, that those things are the functional equivalents of declaring war. And I just read that and, you know, thinking about it a little bit, is that really a functional equivalent? Is that the same thing? And, you know, why is it that we would say, if we're going to read it, that Congress can declare war, why say just major wars and leave open this whole swath of area where people can engage in conflict and president can command troops and all that?
Yeah, I've never been that persuaded by the authorizations of war. But to the extent they're relevant, they actually show that, yes, the declaration of war is like almost ceremonial. It's something you do to show a very high status to the hostilities rather than who starts the hostilities and how they're started. So we've only had five of them in our history, but we have fought by one count 100 conflicts. Does that mean all 96 other ones were unconstitutional in some way? You know, no. I think it's just that declarations of war just don't have to do with starting hostilities. They actually have a lot more to do. And that's why it's in a clause. It also is about the Markham Reprisal Clause and setting the rules for capturing any vessels. Like, why are those all in the same sentence? Because those are all about the international legal status of your actions. Are you fighting a war under international law? Are you seizing enemy cargoes? If you are, during wartime, you get to keep them as booty. But if not, then you have to give them back. Letters of Mark and Reprisal are like that movie, Master and Commander, where you can fly, you know, a ship can go around and even though you're not fully at war, you can take enemy vessels and keep everything. All those clauses are about this technical international law stuff. They're not, any of them are about how do we decide whether to go to hostilities against another country.
One of the other questions, and we can end on this one, it's about a presidential authority in wartime. And there's a long and complicated series of things that happen after 9/11 that starts with an executive order. And then we have some congressional legislation, some Supreme Court cases, all about indefinite detentions of people who are designated to be enemy combatants. And I'm curious, we could talk about this for a long time, but just a kind of a brief overview of the legal status as it currently is with people who are being detained. And Guantanamo is the most high profile place that's been in the news, and President Obama came into office campaigning on closing down Guantanamo. As far as I know, it's still open and there are still people in this legal status.
Yes, that's true. Guantanamo is still there. It still has members of Al-Qaeda there. They're still trying to hold war crimes trials there. Mm-hmm. And as you may know, I was involved in some of those decisions very early on after 9/11 as a member of the Justice Department. And the view we held, which I think was ultimately approved by the Supreme Court, was that if we are at war with Al-Qaeda, and that's a fundamental question, can you be at war with a non-state? But once you are, then you capture prisoners. And in wartime, you don't try prisoners. They're not guilty of a crime just for fighting against you. So what do you do with prisoners? You don't have to release them because they'll go right back to fighting. And so what detention is during wartime is just holding people you've captured until the fighting ends, and then you can release them. And that's still the status of Guantanamo Bay and the people there today, because we don't think the fighting against Al-Qaeda is over. I mean, I have very little doubt that if we released people from Guantanamo Bay, they would try to rejoin Al-Qaeda and continue the fighting. A lot of the other people who were once there were returned to their countries, and they were held there or tried there. But they still fall under this generic idea, this laws of war idea that in wartime, you will capture people. The humane thing to do is not to kill them. The humane thing is just to detain them until the war is over. Now, that sometimes people say indefinite detention. It is indefinite in the sense that you don't know when the war is over because it's still going on. It was equally, I think, indefinite for soldiers captured during World War II who were German and Japanese because they were held. You didn't know in 1943 when the war was going to be over. It might have seemed equally indefinite. But you can't actually hold them forever. You have to hold them until the fighting is over, and then you have
to. And it's hard to imagine in this scenario, though, what an exchange of prisoners after the war would look like. You know, unless we're willing.
This is something we don't know a lot about, which is how do you bring the war to an end against a fanatical non-state terrorist group, against a nation? You know, you have a peace treaty, and then you release the prisoners, and they go back home. But I don't know
what is the end look like in that scenario. Part of the justification for this was that it was inherent in the executive. It was part of the executive power during wartime to take these kinds of actions. But in a paradoxical kind of way, President Obama seemed to be limited in his power to close down Guantanamo because of legislative actions. Is that right? And are there ways in which the president can be constrained even in these kinds of decisions?
It's an interesting question. So first, I'd mention is that this is the exact theory that Lincoln had. And so as a Justice Department official, we didn't have any precedents to look at really about what do we do. So actually, I went back and looked at Lincoln because that was a case where you were fighting people who had been American, they were considered American citizens. And so Lincoln actually said, we're not going to try them as criminals. We're going to just hold them in prisoner of war camps. And then when the Civil War is over, we're released. So that's where the model for us came from. President Obama, it's interesting that your second question is exactly what I argue is how Congress still maintains a major check on wartime operations. Is President Obama wanted to close Guantanamo Bay. He wanted to transfer all the people held there to New York City because he wanted them tried in civilian court in New York City. And so Congress just said there will be no funding for any transfer of prisoners out of Guantanamo Bay to the United States. And that, so even though, yes, the president's commander in chief and he makes all the tactical and strategic decisions in wartime, including where to put Al-Qaeda members, and President Bush chose Guantanamo Bay, still you can't do anything without money. And Congress tightly controls the purse strings and can, I've always argued, always in the end have its way. Starting wars, continuing wars, or ending wars based on how much money they're going to let the president have.
Yeah, Congress has an enormous amount of power when it wants to use its power, when it decides to do that. Well, John, that was a fascinating conversation. Thanks for spending a few minutes with us. I know you have a new book out. Can you say just a little bit about your new book?
So it's called Defender in Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. Just came out over the summer. Of course, I had to be counterintuitive. So I had to take on everyone who said Trump's a threat to the Constitution and destroying the Constitution. I actually was one of the people who was worried about that 4 years ago. I was not a Trump supporter. And I was worried that, the classic confrontation between a populist and, the status quo or the constitutional order was looming. But the counterintuitive argument I make is that Trump has actually been the bigger defender, unintentionally, of the the original Constitution than those who seek to remove him.
That's fascinating. How's it doing so far? Getting some good press. I've seen talking about it a few places, listening to a few podcasts.
Hey, I'm joining you. I'm selling books here. Come on.
Well, we appreciate it. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thanks, Justin. It's great and happy to come back.